Wine is for the spirit, what water is for the soul. Particularly in Italy, wine is the poetry of the earth. Were I looking to tenuously justify the use of these quotes to introduce a podcast about the equally tenuously connected worlds of wine and cycling, I could tell you that both sentences were pronounced by the first man to complete the Giro d'Italia. Of course, that would be a lie. Mario Soldati was a playwright, novelist, film director, war reporter and TV host, not a professional cyclist. His tour of Italy, in its first incarnation, was catchily named A Trip in the Po Valley in Search of Genuine Foods. An Italian saw it, a seminal programme in the early history of Italian television, in 1957, in most cases before they had watched the actual Giro.
Dottor Tarantola, senta, mi dica una cosa, questi qui sono pieni, questi qua. Queste sono piene, la bottiglia, il segreto di queste qua sono le cose.
Quando lei fa fare la gastronomic voyage was also, though, inspired by the Corsa Rosa, of which he had been a lifelong follower. He even wrote a book about the first campionissimo, Costante Girardengo. He also declared one day that the rider who later inherited that title, Fausto Coppi, ought to be studied by every Italian schoolchild. Soldati died in 1999. Among his many legacies, it is often said he taught Italians about Italy, including through the medium of wine. His more comprehensive road trips far beyond and beneath the Po Valley in 1968, 1970 and 1975 provided the material for a book, Vino al Vino, which is still regarded as one of the holy tomes on the subject. Hence we feel somewhat vindicated in channeling the spirit of Mario Soldati. That is to say, or paraphrase him, that wine is the poetry of the earth and the Giro, an annual recital of this as well as another art form, an audiovisual feast of glinting spokes and whirring wheels across the glorious expanse of Italy. More simply, and finally getting to the point, this year again, we're inviting the wine enthusiasts and wine curious among our listenership to discover and enjoy six wines produced on or close to lands traversed by the Giro. Once more, we have curated our Giro Vagando selection with Greg Andrews and Luciano Girotto of Divine Cellars in London, and you can buy the case on their website at www.divinecellars.com. That is www.divinecellars.com. What you're about to hear is my conversation with Greg and Luciano after our official tasting or degustazione of the wines at the Divine Shop in South London just over a week before I set off for Italy. Before that, two words of warning. One, we strongly urge you to only ever consume wine in moderation. And two, those who find conversation about wine dull, pretentious, or totally irrelevant to the brief of a cycling podcast, none of those are reasonable positions, should probably skip ahead in their podcast feed now. Our wine-free, cycling-only race preview is coming later in the week. Meanwhile, it's cin cin, salute, and a toast to wine, the Giro, and Mario Soldati. Well, that concludes the official tasting 2023 cycling podcast Divine Cellars Giro Vagando Degustazione. Buon Giro to all of you, and what a session it was, and what a cracking selection you've picked for us, Greg. I'm joined by Greg Andrews and Luciano Girotto. Luciano, of course, our resident, well, Greg's resident Italian expert. Luciano, you were here last year as well. You helped us out last year. We're going to get on to the wines we've chosen in just a minute, but how are you, first of all?
Really good and really excited to see Giro 23 come around, particularly with an Australian victor last year, if my memory's correct.
Well, particularly, I mean, the Tour de France has always captured my interest, but the Giro is definitely on the radar and certainly been so for the last few years or so. And good to see someone else take over from Cadel Evans, really, sort of, yeah, which is too long ago.
And you've been in Australia back in
literally
the,
just
the
back
fatherland.
Yeah,
recently.
So just back from Australia, you know, last weekend, sort of researching some more wines, seeing what else we can pick up, maybe do something for the Tour of Australia next year.
And both of you, before we crack on with the usual, as usual, we're going to go in order. We're going to go around the Giro route this year. You're going to tell us what you've selected and why you've selected it. But let's talk a little bit first about the wine industry and Italian wine in the last year.
What are the sort of main themes last year that you've seen, guys? I mean, a lot of people talking about inflation, cost of living, cost of wine, unfortunately, has gone up, hasn't it? The cost of producing wine has gone up. Climate change in Italy last year, I think it was the driest year since 1800, the driest summer.
It will start also this year as well. So they got problem already with water.
But Luciana, so rain. To explain a little bit about what that affects, because if you look at just the figures themselves, production, and even if you read stuff about the quality that was produced last year, it was still good, it was still decent, and the quantity was still high. Italy is still the highest, still the biggest producer of wine in the world, but it makes everything more difficult in the vineyard, doesn't it?
Yes, you need to select more in a vineyard, also on the sorting table, and you need to be more hours on and vineyards and really detect any single grapes then they're not producing fine. And the producer really worry at the moment because really the lack of water determine also the start on springtime to the flowering buds and the vines, how can cope during the vintage and during the season.
And I mentioned I word inflation. How's it affect?
Well, certainly, you know, with our latest imports from Italy, we have seen price increases, not just from the producers themselves, because of the increased bottle prices. I mean, the cost of glass has increased because of the increasing cost of energy. The cost of transport has also increased because of the, you know, various increase in fuel prices and so forth. But obviously, with the Ukraine war, that's had an impact. Where I'd probably say, certainly, transport costs have definitely increased about 20%, which has been pretty brutal. But you know, the glass price, most producers have probably gone up 5-10%. You know, in cases because of those additional costs that they have to deal with. So That's all been factored in, and I think in many respects people will have started to look towards maybe not necessarily drinking French, but maybe sort of being a bit more adventurous and drinking some of the newer or lesser known varieties from Italy. And that's where we're starting to see a little more curiosity. You know, Nero di Troia, for example, has been quite popular, and various other sort of, you know, varieties, particularly a couple we've got, the one particular one we've got for the case this year. People's interest has peaked in terms of where else they can get quality wines from or what else they can get. And I think for us, that's a great challenge to have in terms of being able to introduce something new to people that possibly represents better value than, for example, for lack of a better word, but something like a Barolo or a Nebbiolo, which are still great wines. But because of those inflationary costs, they're now looking towards something a bit more cost-effective, you know, comparably.
Yes. I have to say then also the producer that we import directly from Italy, they really were keen to help us and not to raise too much the price of the wine we were taking from them. And lucky enough, really, we were really be able to just contain the rising prices.
Thinking about other wine trends in the last year or so, one that was not one of the main ones, but one I was reading about the other day, de-alkalized wine. Is that a dirty word around here? There are none in the case this year, and I don't think there will be for a while. I was in Mallorca a couple of weeks ago, and I went into quite a fancy sort of agro mart that was called, and I saw a white wine, an interesting looking white wine called 00, and I really should have known that it was de-alkalized. And I discovered this, and once I'd poured it and once I'd drunk it, I thought, lacking a bit of acidity, lacking a bit of something, looked at the bottle, 0.0.
I think for us, I mean, we've certainly come across and we get introduced to a large amount of de-alkalized wines or alcohol-free alternatives. And from our experience, one of the biggest barriers is they're also often so sweet because obviously the sugars aren't fermented out. So what invariably we send a lot of people who are pitching these to us away. But you know, Riesling has been we've got a very good Riesling and a very good sparkling Chardonnay that we do from time to time. But in the main, we struggle to, particularly in reds, we struggle for the quality. You know, we feel the quality doesn't measure up, or as a replacement to wine. So if you want something that's without any alcohol, I think there are other better options, like, you know, sparkling tea or other more other herbal or other sort of, I suppose, vermouth type of alternatives that do the same thing.
The difficulty with de-alcoholized wine, in my experience of having drunk one bottle, is that you know, you want to sip wine, don't you? But then you find yourself drinking a de-alcoholized wine, and it's thirst quenching. It's like a grape juice, and you feel as though you want to sink the whole bottle. Especially when you know, on that particular day, I was dehydrated and I was thirsty, so I didn't really want to sip it.
Yeah, and I think in terms of it just feels different from a. For me personally, it feels different from a wine. You know, as you say, you want to. You're treating it more as I treat it more as a soft drink almost. Mm. It's thirst quenching, and then if I want something with dinner, I'll probably move on to something else. You know, in terms of, and if I don't want to drink for whatever reason, I'll probably sort of choose one of the non-wine alternatives that are available. And there are, you know, we do several, but it's just I'm quite disappointed with the general level of quality on de-alcoholized wine. It just doesn't feel like
Is anyone guys doing sort of taking half the alcohol out or a decent percentage of the alcohol out? It seems quite binary. It seems to be de-alcoholized or, you know, the full shebang.
They may well be doing it, and Luciana may know, but what we find is it's either all or nothing in some respects. You know, we haven't been introduced to anything that's a mid-strength wine, so to speak. What we would probably prefer to do is then hunt out lower alcohol wines that are naturally made.
Which, you know, is around there
10%, things like that.
And there is a bit of a move in that direction in the wine industry, isn't there?
Yeah.
Counter to climate change, which makes wines more alcoholic.
People are more aware of alcohol in the wine, so we got more and more clients then really they want to see how much alcohol is on the wine. And but also, I would say then it seems then the beer with no alcohol is more spot on in terms of quality than wine. Wine is still difficult to find something decent.
And I think you're better off drinking a lower alcohol wine, like some Rieslings we see around 10-11%. Mm. One of the wines in the case is only 12%. Mm. So rather. Have a glass of, you know, I'd rather have a glass of that and put the cork in and come back to it tomorrow. And certainly some, a lot of the wines we have the acidity and the structure to last a day anyway. I mean, you know, it depends on how you're storing it, really. I mean, some of the reds you can probably stretch a bit further, but it's, for us, in terms of a greater trend, we haven't found a de-alkalized wine that replaces authentic wine.
Still guessing on fueling? Not sure what or when to eat and drink on rides that matter? Never again. Optimize your fueling strategy with real-time glucose data, actionable insights, and personalized analytics. We're here to help you achieve your performance goals. Go to supersapiens.com for more on how to track your energy levels and fuel for success. The Cycling Podcast, powered by Super Sapiens.
We're 10 minutes in. I didn't envisage us talking about the alcoholized wine. It's very difficult to say. I find it very difficult to say. 10 minutes into the podcast. So let's crack on. Let's get to what the Giro refers to as the Grande Partenza in Pescara, in Abruzzo. And, well, you have excelled yourself, Greg and Luciana, because I don't think we've ever been this close to the route before. I think that the Cantina Rapino, which is the producer of the first one, Gira, also sounds a bit like Giro. I think it might even be on the route or within a few hundred meters of the route on stage two. Stage one finishes about 6 or 7 kilometers from the cantina. Stage two might go past the front door, I think. Now, after about 105 kilometers. Anyway, we've tasted it. Luciana, passerina can mean literally little sparrow in Italian.
Yes.
Tell us about the wine.
Indeed, passerina... takes the name from a little bird and eats the sweetest part of the grapes any now and then when he found the right spot. And Emilio, the producer, Emilio Rapino, the producer, really want to emphasize one of the native grape varieties of Abruzzo. In this case, the wine is 5 days with a contact skin while fermenting, and then he keeps the wine in concrete containers, then tank, for 2 years. So he's not rushing to bottle the wine because he wants to take the wine takes his time to adjust, to get ready, dress properly, and be present to the public in due time. So after 2 years in concrete, he spent another year in bottle, and then he goes to the market. So it's something that is completely beautiful wine that is relaxed. The wine is beautiful golden color, and there is the sun in the glass for me. There is beautiful nose of tropical fruit, a little bit of boxiness as well. So there is a bit of herbal or Mediterranean herbs, and it's lightly bitter in the end, just to probably present the food that is in the area. Yes, it's fish, but also it's meaty fish, all white meat as well. So Emilio told me that they also drink this wine with lamb, which can be possible.
We're in Arosticini country, aren't we?
Exactly, yes.
Which are lamb kebabs that I probably won't be eating any of, but Brian might be.
You will witness all.
And you mentioned the colour of this wine. This is a characteristic of this grape, isn't it? The sort of...
It is, yes.
Very yellow.
Yes. Colour.
Although it's... You said skin contact, so another buzzword that we've heard a lot in the last couple of years, orange wine. Skin contact wine is orange wine.
Yes.
Although this isn't... This is more yellow, isn't
it? Yes, but Emilio doesn't really want to call it orange. He doesn't want to fit this wine into a pigeonhole. He said, I like it to do it in this way. I'm not a natural winemaker. My wine are as I want them make it, and if you want to define the natural, then I'm natural. But that's it. The wine color is classic from the grape variety, so any Passerina wines is this color anyway.
And Greg, we were saying we think this is the first skin contact orange wine we
certainly
had in the second podcast case.
It feels
we're still dodging the rosé bullet.
Yes,
I'm glad to say.
Well, with it, you know. But it is what the first skin contact white we've used, or overtly skin contact white we've used. And I think, you know, whilst you know, for us in terms of it's just another means of adding texture and complexity to the wine, with particularly in with skin contact wines, you don't have to use oak. I mean, some do, but the reality is it's just another tool in the winemaking toolbox that people use to create texture and create something interesting. And we spoke about trends at the beginning of this afternoon's conversation. Skin contact wines, orange wines, are a very real trend that we're seeing a lot of people want to explore, want to get to understand, and want to see more.
Sort of split opinion in the wine industry, don't they? I've got friends who work in the wine industry who think it's a load of old hogwash and think that white wine, white grapes are not really made. They don't really add anything to...
Definitely, there's various schools of thought. I think a lot of our challenge as a retailer is introducing people to the different styles of skin contact wine. So you have a more modest expression, which is probably what we're drinking here. And then you have some of the more aggressive, severe options that can be likened to a cold cup of tea, you know, in terms of their tannic, and they have their place depending on what you're eating with. But I think... The consumer, you know, we see a lot. Consumers will come in and ask, oh, I want an orange wine. And you delve a bit deeper. And
do you guys think it's a fad? Do you think it's something that's going to disappear? And then it's along with small plates in restaurants. I hope they exit stage very soon because they're driving.
We are opening a Pandora box at the moment.
What do you think, Luciana? Pandora's box in your skeptic? Or
No, because it's divided opinion. The trend is slightly going down of orange wine. Also, not just for the consumer point of view, but producer point of view, because we saw in the last 3 years the producer they were strongly believer in making just orange wines are not make them anymore. Mm. They're more gentle. They are, say, making wine. They're more, in a way, traditional, but they are really... understand probably then people now is getting tired, but the wines weren't stable enough.
Mm.
And they were bottle variation. And for them was a damage in the end of image and also sales, I suppose.
Yeah.
I think what we're seeing is in terms of, from producers and consumers alike, a greater understanding of the category that has been, is probably one of the original winemaking techniques. If you think about a lot of wines that were made in amphora were made as skin contact, whether they would be white or red. So I think as a style, the producers, the consumers are starting to understand a little bit about it. So I think as a trend, it's here to remain, but it will become less as a fad, if you know what I mean. I mean, in terms of people are latching onto it, a bit like natural wine. But I think people are starting to understand it more as just getting to its feet a little bit more.
I mean, there's definitely a novelty value, isn't there? When people see the list of wines comes in the restaurant, they see the red, they see the white, and then there's another section. There's also a cosmetic element to it. I mean, people are not actually getting a wine that looks... I mean, it doesn't look like an Aperol Spritz, not quite. But it does, you know, there is an orange hue to it. And I think on a summer's day, in the same way that I think one of the things that makes people drink rosé is they like the look of it in a glass, you know, a sort of fresh, dewy glass of rosé. And it's the same with orange wine to a certain extent.
Yes, yes. I think as Greg said, the orange wine, they are here to stay. It just, they will be more refined and more established and not be as a odd category, but just something then we need to add on the red or white or sparkling section. Yes, I agree with you, yes.
The Cycling Podcast at the Giro d'Italia is supported by Science and Sport. Science and Sport, fueled by science.
Wine 2. It's quite a long wait until Wine 2. We are going down. Gregor, in the initial selection, there was something from Puglia. But I pulled you up on that and I said, we're not really going into Puglia. We're sort of skirting the top of it. And the next stage on which we have a wine is stage 7. And the stage starts in Capua. And close to Capua is Benevento. And we've got a wine that comes from near Benevento, between Capua and Benevento. And it's the Falanghina del Sannio. 2020 Cantina del Taburno. Taburno is a sort of mountain, well, it's a mountain massif between Benevento and Capua, where we're starting. We're in Campania still, aren't we, Luciana?
Oh, yes.
Definitely. Yeah. Campania, yes. The Sannio, so there's a Falanghina del Sannio, the Sannio region, that's so called, it's a region within a region, named after the Samnite people, ancient peoples way before Christ, but it's that part of Italy and that part of Campania has retained that name.
Yes.
So tell us about the Falanghina 2020.
So Falanghina is one of the native grape variety of Campania, but the Greek took Falanghina to us. This Falanghina in particular comes from a cooperative that is around the 70s, from 300 confettors, and the Falanghina is one of the best wine they are making since the beginning. From ancient vines as well, so some Falanghina vines are more than 100 years old. The soil is volcanic, so fantastic, rich minerality in the wine. But also this wine, as I mentioned on the information then, is not just famous in Campania, but is really famous all over Italy because people recognize that it's fantastic white wine. Can be an easy going, but also rich and, with flavors and aromas. This one is completely stainless steel, made in stainless steel. So there is very an uncomplicated wine, but with a lot of pear, apple, flintiness, a little bit of minerality, very saline, and long finish. It's an aperitif wine, but also classic combination is spaghetti with ravioli.
Ah, okay. Even though we're quite a long way inland with this.
Oh, yes, yes.
We're also in mozzarella country very much here.
Yes, that's true.
Could we...
I also said a bit of mozzarella pomodoro. Okay, let's extend it. Mozzarella di bufala. And tomato, definitely.
Well, Luciana and Greg, two wines down, we're heading up into my favourite part of Italy now, into the centre towards sort of Umbria, Tuscany, Emilia Romagna. Luciano, you're from the northeast. You're from Friuli. Is that also where your heart is, as far as Italy is concerned? Is that, if you had to go anywhere in Italy, would it be to the northeast?
Northeast, but also Sicily, Campania.
We've had the Sicily conversation before.
I'm going to Naples in 15 days, testing wines.
Oh, really?
Quite happy.
Have you watched the White Lotus hit TV series set in Sicily, the second series?
Not yet. It's on my list.
If anyone who watches that will want to go to Sicily, however, I would suggest that it gives a slightly distorted perspective of Sicily. It's very beautiful, and Sicily can be beautiful. The geography is also completely muddled up in it. In one second, they're in Taormina, and they go down to the beach, and they find themselves in Cefalù, and so on and so forth. But watch it, by all means. You'll enjoy it, I'm sure. Greg, if you were to go on holiday in Italy, where would you? I'll give you a voucher, Greg, at the end of this podcast.
Like yourself, I'm a big fan of Tuscany, to be honest. I think, you know, part of the reason is that, you know, you've got the seaside, and then you can go into the rolling hills, and you just get a real diversity.
Thumbs are down.
It does get damn hot, but that's not a problem. But
I'm going to ask Luciano to explain it.
But to be fair, I haven't been to Sicily yet, so I can't. You know, I haven't dipped my toe in the waters down there. But for me, sort of Tuscany has been fabulous. I've really enjoyed it.
Luciano, what is the not to like about Tuscany?
You put me in trouble now.
Oh,
personally, I think that a bit too noble. Too reserved. When you are in Campania, in Sicily, there is the warmth of the people, how they welcome you, then really for me, it's always been impressive. And I feel more at home, even if I'm really deeply from the north, but I'm quite happy to be in the south.
Well, that conveniently brings us on to our Tuscan wine in this year's case.
Yes.
And, it's called Sincero, means sincere. And, you were very sincere there, Luciana, about your views on Tuscany.
Yes, and now I will be, arrested.
On the naughty list.
When I go to Tuscany.
With this producer. Greg is a producer that we've featured before. We've featured different wines from this producer. This is, so we've got the Sincero. It's 70% Sangiovese, very typical for wines in Tuscany to be, well, red wines to be predominantly Sangiovese, but it's also got a bit of Cabernet Franc in there, a bit of Cabernet Sauvignon. Tell us about this wine.
Yes, so part of the reason why I like Tuscany so much is primarily because my good friend Francesco makes the wines for Cosimo Massini. Sincero is a wine that he's made the 12 years I've known Francesco. Lovely, bright, you know, I suppose, blend of Sangiovese and Cabernet Franc. He likes to keep it fresh, but equally sort of, because of that, it's got some nice weight to it, where you can, you know, it's quite versatile at the dinner table, you know, something a bit more meaty, but equally if as a wine by the glass, it's also had, you know, quite versatile in that respect. Sangiovese is their primary grape, where as we've known from the previous tours, he makes a Chianti, he makes, you know, 100% Sangiovese in terms of Nicole, which are named after the original owner's children. Francesco, his expression is to reflect the vintage. He doesn't like to work to a recipe necessarily. He'd rather work with the cards he's been dealt with. He does work biodynamically. He does work minimal intervention. Some may say you could perceive this as a natural wine, but that's not his objective. His objective is to make a wine that reflects the vintage and reflects where it's from. And, you know, as an area of San Bignato, is also well known for its truffles. Once a year in November, they have a truffle festival, which, you know, I need to take up its hospitality, you know, and sort of head out there in November. But, you know, in terms of, again,
slightly aggrieved that we haven't been offered any.
Yes, well, we need to.
Yeah, as well. Stage 10, Francesco, if you're listening. Scandiano to Viareggio.
There's a beautiful part of Tuscany where the winery and the villa is based. So
I think it's my appreciation of Tuscany is very heavily influenced by Francesco. So, and certainly San Miniato, where you've got just a fabulous you know, those rolling hills that I mentioned in the first discussion, you know, you see that in spades around San Mignan. So, and particularly in terms of you've got some, the wine has its own sort of fabulous imprint, and you're only sort of half an hour, 45 minutes from the sea. So that ocean influence does have an influence where they are. And, you know, in terms of it keeps the wine is slightly fresher. It's not, it's never baked.
How does this compare both you to, well, you mentioned Francesco, there's a Chianti.
Yes.
Chianti is synonymous with Tuscany. Tuscany is synonymous with Chianti. That's predominantly Sangiovese as well.
Yes.
With other blends are still allowed, aren't they? Although the regulations have been, it's not allowed anymore. The regulations have been tightened up a lot over the years, haven't they?
Yeah. Chianti Gran Selezione now banned completely, let's say, international grape varieties, so Cabernet Merlot. So it needs to be 90% of Sangiovese and an addition of local grape variety, which are Canaiolo, Mammolo, Malvasia Nera.
Is San Forte part of that as well?
And it's too precious, and also there are not many people who make San Forte, which is not Sangiovese, is a completely different grape variety. Oh, yes, then they discover.
We're going to move on. We're going to move on, both of you, to stage 14. And we are going to have a short incursion into Switzerland, which some of my colleagues don't feel particularly enthusiastic about or aren't enthusiastic about, because not everyone loves Switzerland who covers bike races. I have quite a lot of affection for Switzerland, and I lived there for a few months, a few years ago. So we're going from Sierre, which is in the Valais, which is a big wine producing region in Switzerland, and we're going to back into Lombardy to Cassano Magnago. And we are going to come very close to the Piedmont border, if we're not actually in Piedmont right at the end of that stage, and then we go back into Lombardy. But we're going to go pretty close to the winery that produces the next wine, which is a Nebbiolo. So same grape variety as Barolo, which is, of course, the most famous wine from Piedmont. But this is what's called Bocca, and it's made by a gentleman called Davide Carlone. What's it like, chap? Well, we've just been poured another glass. We've already tasted this once. We're going to taste it again. Tremendous.
There's some left in the bottle, so it'll waste not want not. I can also say that Luciano recently did a Nebbiolo masterclass, and this featured heavily in that masterclass. And I personally think this is, whilst the contents of this year's Giro d'Italia is, you know, is very solid.
It's the MVP, Greg.
This is the number one draft choice. Yeah, this is the, you know, I really think this is a standout 2012 vintage. But
2012, I think that's the oldest wine we've ever had on.
I think it was 2015 up until this year. So a bit of a find, but yeah, I'll let Luciano speak more about it.
We were lucky enough to find the bottles that we needed on this vintage. Needs to say then 2012 is not the best vintage for Nebbiolo, but all vines, high altitude, and the craftsmen of these traditional winemakers really made possible to have a pleasant wine with fine tannins, but round also. Also, there is a little bit of Espolina. There is another native grape variety from that area, from Alto Piemonte. Normally, all these beautiful wines, and they've been very famous between the two wars, and they were really the red wine to drink from Piedmont. Barolo and Barbaresco, yes, they were still there, but not as famous as Bocca, Gemme, Gattinara. Again, small winery here, very traditional. I think there is the fifth generation. The last one is really taking care of the tradition that they've been all the centuries, through all the centuries, but also to innovate a bit. So they plant new vines in a different way than they used to be. They preserve the beautiful landscape, because here they are all terraces. And they are cleaning up the vineyards then they've been reclaimed from wood. So really they've been, this area was abandoned somehow because was easier to go to work in a factory, in textile particularly, because the water there is wonderful, and the area really is very famous for either rice or textile.
It is off top country.
Yes, yes, definitely. So this bocca has quite an intense color to be Nebbiolo predominant. Beautiful dry rose and a bit of pepperiness because Vespolina. Is round and is ready to be drunk right now. So yes, is an important wine. Can hold a little if somebody doesn't want to drink it right now, but I think it's beautiful to enjoy it right now.
And it's got that sort of strawberry with leatheriness that you use.
Multi-layers, yeah, yeah.
Nebbiolo.
Yes, it's really, you find a little bit of tobaccos, a bit of vegetal note, but also wood when it's wet, a little bit of fresh cut grass, this white strawberry. The floral note for me is quite interesting. And as soon as we tested it the first time, I want this one for the Giro.
Greg, you know, this is right up my alley. We're, you know, no more of those tippy-tappy orange and pink.
No, in part we did have your taste in mind when we chose this particular wine. We wanted something with
serious stuff.
With a
this
bit
is
of adult. Depth.
This yeah, is exactly. Wine for adults
with a bit of depth. So you can keep dipping back into the glass, and every time you'll go back and pull out another profile or flavor profile, you'll see something different. And I think, you know, it really does offer. I think for the case, really does offer amazing, you know, amazing quality. With the budget we're working with. And I think, you know, it's definitely for us, I think, one of the better wines we probably put into any of the cases we've done. I mean, we, you know, it's a bit like we stock all the wines and we believe in all of them. But I think this particular one was kind of a gem and an opportunity too good to miss, really. And definitely food-wise, in terms of as we're getting, you know, well, the English summer's not here yet, so definitely... Definitely
Spring's
risotto.
Not here, yeah.
Exactly. Definitely, you know, some risotto, some heartier meals. It'll definitely sit very well. Yeah.
Stew, deer, steak, but stew then is typical dish from the that area is.
Luciana, can I ask you a question about, we mentioned risotto.
Yes.
And cooking wine. This is a question that a lot of people might have. I make a lot of risotto, and I often find myself hesitating over what kind of wine to use. Usually in, well, I love risotto.
White?
Well, yeah, but what kind? Should it be an acidic wine? Should it be a full-bodied wine? Does it really matter?
It does. Because if you think to use maybe a wine, then you open is smell of cork. For example, you don't use that because the cork, you will find it on the risotto in the final test of your risotto. So normally it's quite, I think the sharpness of the white one will be nice. So no full body, no oaky wines. Just okay. White, almost neutral white wine.
Okay.
I think one of the bigger factors is if you're not going to drink the wine, why put it into a risotto that you're going to eat it? Because those same flavours that you don't like will be persistent in the food you're making. Now,
there are limits to that, Greg. Yeah. I shan't be going upstairs after this podcast and picking out a bottle of 1982 Aubryon for my risotto.
Although I have heard some horror stories of misselected bottles of wine going into a beef bourguignon. But particularly with risotto, you can... either in terms of the wine can be oxidized, that's not a problem, but particularly as Luciano.
So old, yeah. A few days
so,
old.
So if you've got a bottle of wine that you haven't finished in the fridge, yeah, that'll work. Yeah. You know, that'll certainly work. There's no crime in that. But as Luciano said, if a wine is corked or if a wine is so heinous and you hate the flavour, don't use it. You know, I think, and, you know, you can be militant about it, but the reality is, if you would never drink the wine, don't cook with it. You know, and I'm not saying necessarily you pick a Premier Cru Chablis to go in a risotto, but equally, you know, there needs to be some level of balance there. I think, you know, you wouldn't necessarily put food that you don't enjoy drinking. You sort of don't enjoy eating, so why put a wine that you don't enjoy drinking? You know.
Well, we're going to move on, but I mentioned The White Lotus earlier to reference another hit TV drama, and to paraphrase Logan Roy, this is a wine for serious people, this one, I think. Stage 17, we start in Trentino in Pergine and Val Sugana, and we head right down into the Veneto. We're getting close now, Luciana, to your neck of the woods, but... This wine is from, well, we talked about the wine down in Campania. It's from the just to the side of that mountain massive, the Taburno. This is just on the sort of on the flank of a little hill outside Treviso called the Montello, which is famous in cycling because the World Championships in 1985 took place. Well, it went up and down the Montello on several occasions, and this wine is from there, in the Montello. Nervesa della Battaglia is the village, and the wine itself is called, well, it's Recantina, Serafini Vidotto are the producers, and I think, Greg, it featured last year in our best of case at the end of the year, is that right?
Yes.
Or not best of, or no, quite make the cut case.
Effectively the end of year case that we do to sort of sum up the various tours, where we had some runners and riders, effectively the runners and riders, where we were looking at various things that were a possibility. Well, certainly it was very close run. We almost put in the selection last year, but it's too good to miss out again. I think it's really worth being as part of the full Giro, especially with that trend we mentioned about people taking interest in the lesser known great varieties. I think this particularly puts a spotlight on that and sort of will hopefully sort of introduce people to something different.
So the Veneto, the biggest wine producing region in Italy, I think, stereotypically the biggest drinkers in Italy, the Veneti.
Veneto in Friuli. Yeah. Giulia, yes, you can say that. But it's cold there. It's cold over there. We need a caffè corretto in the morning with a bit of grappa. And then we need a grappa after lunch and after dinner.
Maybe we should talk about de-alcoholized grappa. Luciana, Greg mentioned the grape variety. What is the grape variety?
So, Recantina, ancient grape variety. Then they start to make and produce the wine with the event of the Filosera, so in the end of the 19th century.
Which was the great plague in winemaking.
Yes, kill all the vines in Europe.
It's COVID times 1,000.
Exactly.
As far as vines
were concerned. For the vine.
Yeah.
Serafini Vidotto are two friends. Then they start in 1985 to create this winery. They study enology school together in Conegliano, and they start to make this Recantina around 10 years ago, just because they were looking after somebody else's vineyards, and they recognized that there were some vines and they were quite right. Montello is famous to be one of the epicenter for Veneto for Cabernet and Merlot, thanks to Napoleone invasion, and also because they got beautiful red soil, so rich in iron, and so they start to do some experiment and they start to replant these vines, and they recognize it through also help of the University of Milan. Then was a Recantina grape, then was present there 200 years before, and they are making wines, and they are really this. Particular type is easy drinking. It's medium body, but with again lovely sweet tannins. For me, the first time I tasted it was a lot of strawberry and grass and pepper note, and very joyful. It's very uncomplicated, and that's what they want to make, because Serafini and Vidotto are famous for the red wines, and they're probably one of the best producers in Italy for red wines. But this one in particular is really an easygoing at the moment. Probably the new generation, because Francesco Serafini's son is now taking over part of the winemaking, there will be something more serious, but the vines are still young because they are less than 10 years old, and it's quite an enjoyable wine. Plato pasta, some charcuterie, some cheese, fresh cheese is, I think, the ideal combination. Is full of flavors, an explosion, is a basket of fresh berries with a bit of vegetal note underneath. Like, it's just a joyful, sweet, as I said, sweet tannins, and it's just really typical product from that area in particular.
Difficult to think of anything I would compare this to. You said it's quite a rare Well, it's a rare grape variety, but I can't really think of anything I've tasted.
But the area really is famous because the one of the invasions that they had was Longobard. So
spit roast.
Yes.
Rotisserie.
Yeah, rotisserie. Yeah. Exactly. rotisserie. And is in every single restaurant, trattoria, osteria that you go in Montello, you will have spit roast.
Okay, so stage 17 that was, and we're really, well, the race will be decided over the next few days up in, again, Luciano, in your home region, Friuli. We've got a penultimate day time trial up this Monte Lussari, it's going to be an extremely steep climb. It should be very exciting, but we're right up in the far northeast corner. And then the race is going to slightly ridiculously, ludicrously go all the way to Rome for one day, the last day of the race, for a procession in Rome. And well, this is an opportunity for us at least to drink wine from Lazio, from near Rome, Frascati. Now, I think Frascati, correct me if I'm wrong, I think Frascati has been drunk in the UK, known in the UK for many decades, but has had quite a bad reputation. And the same when we talked about Lambrusco last year or 2 years ago, and it's kind of seen as a bit of a nondescript wine, a wine with no real character. However, if what I've read is correct, the producer that you guys have chosen is a producer that has bucked that trend or bucked that preconceived idea that Frascati has nothing to say for itself. This is a producer that's always produce really interesting Frascati.
The family purchased the property in 1970s, and through a long process of study with Attilio Scienza, then he's one of the luminaries of viticulture in Italy, and teaching Milan University. So they really study each plot to plant each grape variety that was suitable for the soil. It also, they wanted to plant only native grape varieties. So it could be Malvasia, Bellone, other white and red grape variety. So they started after probably almost 10 years of search to bottle their own grapes. And I think it's the first time in a test a real Frascati, a real serious Frascati. And you're right, because Frascati, but not just here. Also, in Italy, when you say Frascati, I say, what? And we think that Frascati is a wishy-washy, easy, tippy-tappy, commercial, pale white wine. Somebody started to make also sparkling wine from Malvasia. But we need to remember that the Colli Romani are volcanic soil, and there are really fantastic tradition of white wine. And Grotta Ferrata is one of the historical village of where you can find a good Frascati. And Castel de Paolis, I think, is one of the first producers that I anchor on my wine life that was fantastic white wine made of Malvasia mainly.
So tell us, what does it taste like? It's not tippy-tappy, we've established that, but what does it taste like?
Well, the color is, at the moment, is a grayish-pinkish, because really the color bit of Malvasia has this type of color. You find floral note, again, freesia. You got the white peach, the apricot, the vegetal note again here, and the flintiness, because the volcanic soil really gives the home to these white varieties to make this wine. And also, this wine is completely stainless steel, so there is no oak involved. It just round, is fresh enough to combine the ripeness of the white fruit and the floral note, and is long, is not an aromatic wine, but it's got its own aromas. And it's very, almost sensual, I would say.
I think, we haven't, I mean, we talk about Frascati as being the previous generation. I think the previous generation was, I think were subjected to a lot of ordinary mass-produced wines. And almost it takes a generation to get rid of that trend or get rid of that bad vibe. And I think Pinot Grigio certainly suffered it. I think
New Zealand's Sauvignon Blanc is definitely in that territory now, where a lot of people will say, I don't do Sauvignon Blanc. You know, and they're almost mentally scarred by it, really. And I think it just takes almost a generation for people to forget about how bad those wines were. And then it takes something of this quality for people to be reacquainted, you know, in terms of the market, to be reacquainted with something that actually delivers a lot of joy.
We talk a lot, we have in the past, last year as well, and just now we talked about, you know, positive sort of innovations, changes, the way things are being sort of almost rebranded, things like Lambrusco and Frascati. Luciano, what's the thing that still annoys you, or what's the thing that grinds your gears at the moment about how Italian wine is sold in the UK, in particular where you live now?
The Italian wines, they should be always cheap, no matter the appellation. Is acceptable to pay good money for a Barolo Brunello, but the rest of the wines, they need to be cheap, no matter who makes the wine and the quality.
Why do you say that?
Because the people in general think that because they go in Italy and they have fantastic experience of drinking wine at a very good price, they should have the same price over here, which they don't understand that we got taxes.
Okay.
Yes, with a lot of taxes, transportation.
So people imagine that Italian wine equals cheap wine.
Yes,
okay.
Yes.
I think accessibility is key. I think we, you know, and I particularly see it, I mean, and certainly Angus does with Spanish wines. You know, we certainly respect that there are quality wines. There's no question about that. And obviously you pay for those. But equally, particularly with new lesser-known varieties and lesser-known regions, we want it to be accessible because we want to introduce people to this, and we want to show people something interesting. And I think when the price is accessible, you get so much more opportunity to do that, you know, in terms of, and especially it then represents a graduation point to say, to then introduce people to something that is a bit more serious or has a bit more bottle age, or there is a bit more premium to it. But I think if you don't have that accessible footstep, you never get that second opportunity. And I think for me, Italy just has such an incredible diversity. And I think one of the facts that I'm constantly reminded of is the sheer amount of indigenous unique varieties that you have in Italy outstrips any other country. It really does. And yes, you have your international varieties, your Cab, your Merlot, your Chardonnays that have, for lack of a better word, infiltrated Italy, shall we say. But you also have so many fantastic varieties, Norella Mascalese, Recantina, as we've had this, you know, this afternoon, Falanghina. There's so many more stories to tell. And I think that's what I think there's so much more opportunity. There's a lot of joy in Italy because of all those stories.
Although, yes, there are still a bit of misconception about Italian wine, I have to say that we are in a good place at the moment because people is very open to find Bocca that they never heard. But, you know, if you tell a bit of a story and the characteristic of the wine, I don't like to describe the technicality of the wine, how the wine is made and how alcohol has or how much acidity has, but more the characteristic of who makes the wine and the history of the place where this wine comes from. And I think the people is more fascinating too. And they buy almost a dream or an experience rather than a technical liquid that is into them.
Am I right to say, though, that you guys in a small kind of independent wine retailer have the luxury and have the ability to do that? It's difficult for supermarkets, for example, where a lot of people, I don't know what percentage of wine is bought at supermarkets in the UK, but it's difficult for
still 80%.
80%. It's difficult for a big supermarket even to have a Passerino or if they have Italian wines, they need recognisable kind of brand names.
I think you're right in terms of people who, you know, we're lucky in that most of our, you know, I'd say 98% of our customers will engage with us, talk about wine, and we can introduce to the wine. Supermarkets, you don't have that opportunity because the person serving you doesn't have that have the knowledge that we fortunately do. So, yes, that is a different, but in terms of, I suppose I like to think of Divine Cellars and other independent merchants as we have that capability to introduce our customers to something new. And what we see is we might introduce a customer to, for example, a varietal, and then 3 years, 4 years later, the supermarkets have started to incorporate that. And as well, you have, you know, you have fantastic programs, you know, in terms of that introduce people to food and wine, and sort of Stanley Tucci's, you know, expose on Italy being a fantastic
example. An hour on what we thought of that program. I wasn't as much of a fan as some other people, but anyway.
No, but what we see is we see people seeing something and then asking, you know, asking for that wine, and you know, particularly Sicily was a perfect example. We had a couple of customers coming in and saying that now, you know, and asking for a wine that was talked about in the program, and you know, whether we can debate whether the program is good or bad, but I think certainly for us, in terms of it's ignited people's interest in terms of various things, you know, that go on. And I think there's other programs as well that have done the same.
Well,
I agree, definitely.
Well, both of you, I'm going to thank you for giving us a fantastic tour, a fantastic Giro before the real Giro. I feel as though we've been around Italy in the space of a couple of hours and six glasses this afternoon. Greg, I've got some bad news for you. I don't think the Australian's going to win the Giro this year.
No, I must admit, I generally enter most Grand Tours thinking an Australian will not feature on the podium. But yeah, so it was a nice surprise last year.
I'm racking my brains now to think of who might continue. But there isn't an Australian among the favourites. It's probably going to be a Slovenia or a Belgian, I would guess.
Slovenia, after all, are Italians.
We really should have, there's a big controversy about this. Have you heard about you're nodding as though you have. There was an Italian, I can't remember, it's not the Italian Tourist Board, but there was a big agency that produces content for Italian tourist agencies who produced a video a couple of days ago showing off all, you know, great landmarks of Italy, but also showing footage, I don't know whether it was drone footage, of a square, typical sort of Italian scene, people drinking Aperol, things like that. And it was in Slovenia and not in Italy.
Venetian domination was still Dalmatia, so, and it's quite obvious the landscape is really reminds you to be in Venice.
Slovenia has made such a mark on professional cycling in the last 3 or 4 years, and thanks to a couple of riders, I'm going to propose that we should have, maybe in the Tour de France case, we should have a Slovenian wine. Have you got any in the shop?
Just reckon we do have a couple. So you know, and certainly when we're doing the review for the Tour de France, we should probably have a bottle of Slovenian wine just to review it in conversation, nonetheless. But I mean, saying that, we've already started sort of crunching the numbers and looking at the French road atlas as to which wines we're going.
It seems unfair if you're not going to have a Danish wine, because the big protagonist in the Tour de France is going to be a Slovenian and a Dane, I would suggest.
That
might be a de-alcoholized wine.
It's probably, although there are a couple of Danish producers, but in terms of, I don't think we'll meet the volumes required, really.
No. I can imagine they're fairly pricey as well. Well, on that note, I'm going to thank you, and we'll be reporting back from Italy over the next 3 weeks, and I hope everyone at home enjoys the case as much as we've just enjoyed tasting it. So thanks, Greg, and thanks, Luciana.
Thank you to give us the opportunity to show some fantastic variety from Italy.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freed, and Lionel Byrne. Ne innamori, che ci riguardi ti e te ne innamori, nani.
When you think work, You think boots. You think boots, you think Ariat. You think grit, concrete, rain, and heat. And boots that never back down from any of it. You think comfort and durability that hold up on the job, off the clock, and every step in between. Because the day doesn't end when the job does. And from overtime to off-duty, you're thinking Ariat boots. Boots that show up, stand out, and always back you up. Now, it's time to stop thinking and start shopping. Find yours at Ariat.com or a retailer near you.